Morning. My name is Francine. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
Francine. Boy, I have to tell you, I didn't realize this room was so big. I think it was 1991 when I spoke here, and it seemed like it was this little, tiny auditorium. And all of a sudden, the rows have increased and increased and increased. I don't know if anybody else felt that way, but it sure seemed like a bigger space than it did 11 years ago. I want to first thank the committee for this wonderful, wonderful, generous gift to come back here. When somebody invites you to speak somewhere once, it's a real gift. And when they invite you to come back, it is such a privilege. So I just want you guys to know that I really so appreciate the invitation. This has been an incredible weekend, and perhaps because I'm a little older, perhaps I've grown up, perhaps my eyes are a little bit more open, I have taken in everything this weekend. Absolutely everything. And one of the reasons that I love coming to conferences is not only do I get to meet new friends, I get to see old friends. This weekend I've met lots of new people. I've gone to meetings every day since I've been here, and I heard some wonderful speakers in the marathon meetings. And I met lots of newcomers, which was really cool. And I want to embarrass you, but I won't. I met a new friend and his beautiful, beautiful girlfriend. I will. James and Corinne. You know, the two of them are so cool. And, you know, it's like when you see new people, young people getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like, whoa, to get it so early, so young. So God bless both of you, and I hope you keep coming back, really. But the real gift for me this weekend was having an opportunity to see old friends. And let me just forewarn you, if you have never heard me speak before, I am a crier. I don't apologize from the podium. You know, it's who I am. And if you have a problem with middle-aged women who can't control their emotions, you might want to leave right about now. Because the older I get and the longer I'm sober, the more I get in touch with who I am. And thank God for that. I got to see Joe this week, and you know what? I haven't seen Joe in years, and yet the irony is that it feels like it was just a couple of years ago since we last saw one another. And it was really, really special to hear you share again. But I have to tell you, the greatest gift for me this weekend was that you connected me with my friend Michael. If you're newly sober and you don't really know what to expect, if you stick around long enough for the fog to lift, you will make friends. You will make friends, some that will become friends for the rest of your life if you're lucky. And if it's not the rest of your life, whatever portion of that journey they get to share with you or you get to share with them. Sometimes the journey may be interrupted because of our stuff. You know, we all come to the table with ego stuff. But if we're lucky, we get to be reconnected again. And Michael and I go back 10 years. And, you know, at the beginning of both of us speaking, we used to always say, I wish we could speak together. I wish we could speak together. And we never, ever shared the podium together until 2 years ago here in San Antonio. And then this weekend, and then we get to see each other again later in the year. And I just wanted to say to you up here, I love you so much, and I have so missed you, so missed you. If you're newly sober, I welcome you and say what an incredible, incredible, incredible gift you are giving to yourselves, the gift of life. And if you're newly sober, you probably think that's a lot of stuff. You know, it's easy for me to say that. Sure, I'm standing up here. I'm 22 plus years of sobriety. It's easy to say that this is the best deal going. But if you are newly sober, I can just ask you to stick around long enough for the fog to lift, for you to be introduced to yourselves. Because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does for you. That's what it did for me. It first taught me how to put down the chemicals one day at a time, and I never, ever, ever in my wildest imaginings thought that was possible. Someone who drank and used drugs like I did, I never thought I could be without a drink one day. But through you, I've learned how not to drink or use drugs for a long, long, long time. But that was only the beginning. And if you are lucky and you stick around here, you will find ways, you will get tools that will teach you how to have the life. A life that you never, ever, ever could have imagined. I get to stand before you this morning as a walking, talking, breathing example of Alcoholics Anonymous in the flesh. I stand up here before you this morning as an example of someone who not only knows how to spell the word dignity, but I know how to define it. Today I am a woman who walks with dignity. A woman who you picked up, you dusted off, and you showed how to have the kind of life that she never thought was possible. That's my prayer for you if you're new. And all it takes is you come in here, you show up, and you change absolutely everything about yourself. Absolutely everything. But the gift is that it doesn't have to happen overnight, and it won't. That's the real gift. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous talks about it being a process, and indeed it is. There is so much more learning for me to do, so much more growing for me to do, and yet, standing where I stand today, I look back over the years at who I was and where I am today, and, you know, sometimes I pinch myself because I don't even believe that I'm the same person that crawled into this program in July of 1979. And yet I am. So if you're new, welcome. And if you don't hear anything from me today that triggers you or tickles your fancy, come back tomorrow and go back tomorrow to another AA meeting and you'll hear another speaker who just might do it for you. I was born 49 years ago in Atlanta, Georgia, so I am definitely a Southern girl, too. I see some hands back there. Absolutely. And I can't tell you that I remember all those early things that happened to me when I was a little baby, you know, in Atlanta, or even when my family moved to New York when I was 6 years old. I don't have a clue what happened. I vaguely remember some things, and I think what I remember most about growing up as a kid was that I just hated who I was. More than anything else, I just remembered hating being in the skin that I was in. And let me just share with you that, you know, a lot of you are not going to relate to the details of my story. You're not, because we just have come from different places. But if your heart is open and your mind's open, you're going to find a way to connect with the feelings. Because I bet you my feelings weren't any different from yours. And that's what I invite you to hear. And as a little kid, like many of you, I grew up just hating the space that I took up on this planet. I couldn't stomach being in the skin. I was black, I was a girl, and I grew up in the South, and I was poor. And I hated all. One of those things alone was a tough thing for me to swallow, but all of those things in concert with each other was just too much for this little kid to bear. And you know, as a little kid, I used to pray to a God I didn't believe in to just not let me wake up sometimes, because the pain was so great just being in this body. I hated my family, I hated my mother, I hated my sister. I mean, I didn't like too many people. I didn't like too many situations. And I remember as a little kid, long before I ever picked up my first drink or drug, I found my earliest escape through books and movies, because that was the key for me. See, it didn't really matter what I used to get out of myself. I just wanted to be out of myself. And books and movies were wonderful. My mom was a librarian, and so we had lots and lots and lots of books in my house. In every room, on every wall, there were reams and reams and reams of books. And it was so cool. I mean, sometimes I'd go take a book off the shelf, and I'd open up those binders, and I'd start to read. And I think my mom probably thought I was just trying to become a smart kid. But what was really happening is that when I opened up those books, when I opened up those binders, for just a moment, I became somebody special. For just one moment in my little life, I became like a Cinderella going to the ball. You see, when I read, I wasn't in my own body. I took on the persona of whoever it was in the books. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful. It took me to a place that I liked being. A place of fantasy. And it was the same thing with old movies. I loved old movies. I loved women like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck and Susan Hayward. They were my idols. They were women that had a cigarette in one hand, a glass in the other hand, and I can tell you they didn't take too much garbage off of anybody, you know. And for me it was really cool. I was this little kid with this huge hole in her gut, and I just needed something to connect with. Just something. And I got it from those movies. I actually learned a lot by watching old movies. I learned how to smoke a cigarette by watching Betty Davis. And this really dates me, and some of you might remember it, but one of my favorite old movies with Betty Davis was All About Eve. And I remember in that movie, Betty Davis is at this party that she threw, and she's walking up that staircase with that long, sexy cigarette holder, talking about it's going to be a bumpy ride. I thought to myself, had she only known how bumpy a ride it was to be. it was to become. I know, but I used to stand in the mirror in my house. Here I am, this little 14-year-old, when I learned how to smoke, and I'd puff and choke, and puff and choke. And some of you that are smokers or former smokers, I'm sure you remember those very early days, puffing and choking, and boy, I'd get dizzy, but it didn't stop me, because I was one of those good addicts. You know, I did it to the hilt. And it was the same thing with drinking. I learned how to hold my glass with my pinky stuck out by watching Susan Hayward in Backstreet. And if you remember Backstreet, there are a few other tricks of the trade I learned by watching that girl in that movie. You know, they were my role models. They were the ones who taught me everything, because I didn't get good role models at home, although, you know what, that's not true today. But as a kid, that's what I believed. I believed I didn't have role models at home, so I had to go outside, and the movies were where I learned how to do everything. Until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I learned how to behave differently by watching women like the women in this room. What a gift it's been for me, and what a journey. The movies worked for a very, very, very long time. They worked for a lot. They worked even in early sobriety. And then, I guess really, they really stopped working, though, when I picked up my first chemicals. See, after a while, they stopped having the strong impact that they had, and I needed something that was quicker, something that would get to really where I wanted to be much quicker than the books and the movies. And so it was about the age of 14 that I discovered the wonderful world of drugs and alcohol. Boy, what do you say? You know, what do you say to a companion that took you through puberty, through everything? Drugs and alcohol introduced me to a life that I never thought was possible, just like sobriety. A life I never thought was possible. And you know, it's interesting, today I know that had I had a crystal ball and been able to look down the road at where I was going to go because of drugs and alcohol, had I really been able to see what was in store for me, I can tell you as I stand before you this morning, I would have never picked up the first chemical. As a woman alcoholic, had I known the places and the people I was to connect with over the next few years of my young life, I would have never done it. Instead, what I would have done, sad as it is, like so many teenagers choose to do today, I would have taken my life. Because you see, there was no way in the world I would have consciously walked into the lion's den knowing what I was going to get. And the life I ended up leading was not the kind of life you want to have your daughter go through. So I would have chosen to cut the lights out. But you see, I believe today as I stand here that even though I didn't believe in God, there was a God working in my life. There has always been a God working in my life, whether I connected with that spirit or not. Lucky for me, today I do. But it was that spirit that I believe gave me what tiny little bit of courage, although it probably wasn't courage, it was just fear. See, I think I was afraid to take my own life because I was afraid I wouldn't succeed. So then I'd be left there, you know, stuck with the pain of being half dead and half alive. But I believe the reason I didn't take my life years and years and years ago was for the one person who's in this room this morning. See, I don't believe most of you will get anything from my story. But I do believe that there is one person in here today who came specifically, whether they knew it was me or not, they came specifically, they were drawn to this meeting because they wanted to see how Alcoholics Anonymous works in the flesh. They wanted to see how you get from point A to point C through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I had to stay alive for that one person in here this morning who just needed to see that this deal really works. And it could be somebody new, and it maybe is someone who's had a lot of sobriety and maybe had a tough time and, you know, it's been a struggle getting through recovery. Whoever it is, that's why I'm here today. I'd like to share a story that describes a lot of how I felt when I was growing up. And better than anything else I could tell you, it really does describe it. And there was a movie that came out about, I guess, 12, 13 years ago. And the movie was called Separate But Equal. It was about the former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall's efforts to make some change in this country. It was about the Brown v. Board of Education case, which ultimately integrated schools in the United States. And in this TV movie, they were trying to understand the impact of segregation on little, small kids. They were trying to understand the impact of segregation on small children's self-esteem. And so they brought all these kids together in a room and they asked them a battery of questions. And there weren't any complicated questions. There were no trick questions involved. But they came to this little girl who was so adorable. She had little freckles and long pigtails with ribbons in her hair. And in answering a question, they asked her to choose between one of four little dolls that were sitting on the table in front of her. There was a little black boy doll, a little white boy doll, a little black girl doll, and a little white girl doll. And they simply asked this little girl to pick out the ugliest doll of all the dolls on the table. And I can tell you, without blinking her eye, without even blushing for a moment, she didn't pick the doll that looked like you, or the doll that looked like you, or even the doll that looked like you. She grabbed a hold of the doll that looked exactly like herself. Because you see, for her, that was the ugliest doll of all four of them. The one that was her own image. And you know what? I'd like to remember that movie, because I'll tell you, the first time I saw it, I was sober a few years, and it pained me so much because I knew exactly what that little kid felt. I knew exactly. I knew what she felt like when I was little. I knew what she felt like even in when I was in early sobriety. I knew what that gnawing felt like that said, you're not good enough, you'll never do it, you'll never amount to anything. You're just a piece of nothing. You see, those voices were always in my head. Always in my head until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and became willing to do some things differently that enabled me to feel differently about myself. But that wasn't to come for a while. In 1978, I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in New York. And, you know, I was only 25 years old, and I just knew this place wasn't for me. I just knew it. You see, I was too young. I was too young, and I was too hip, and at 25 years old, my life had changed so drastically since the way it was when I was a little kid. I mean, I had long since experienced the poverty that I had grown up in. I was so far from the poor place I was when I was a little kid, it was just sickening. And so I knew that I couldn't have been an alcoholic, because for me, alcoholics were men. And if by chance they were women, they were like women on the streets, bums. You know, my idea of an alcoholic person was the old man on the Bowery who used to wear the overcoat and the bottle hanging out of his pocket and the big red veins popping out of his face. That was an alcoholic. And again, if it was a woman, well, Susan Hayward in I'll Cry Tomorrow. You know, when she's digging out of the garbage can, she was an alcoholic. Or it was Lee Remick in Days in Wine of Roses, where she's hiding booze in the greenhouse. I didn't even have a greenhouse. How could I be an alcoholic? You know, that was my thinking. That wasn't me. How could I be an alcoholic? Boy, how easy it is we get to live in that place of denial. It didn't matter that I was coming to in strange places, in strange beds with strange people doing very strange things that I would have never, ever done had I not been drunk or sober. It didn't matter that I had become so vile and so wretched as an alcoholic woman. It didn't matter that I had become willing to compromise myself to the point that I didn't even realize what I was doing was a compromise. That's how bad my drinking got. That's how far down the scale I had to go. I started to accept, and I don't remember which speaker mentioned it the other day, I became willing to accept the totally unacceptable, and it became okay. Because you see, when you're drinking the way I was drinking and using drugs like I was using drugs, the stuff just doesn't matter. All that matters is I can get what I need to take care of the pain. And I became willing to do absolutely anything. I remember when I first was introduced to the program but didn't get sober, I met a woman who had acted as my sponsor, and her name was June. Out in New York, and June was so wonderful. She used to read through the big book, and I remember when she'd come to the passage, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, she never once had to sit and explain to me what those words meant. Never once. Because she knew that I had been there. She never once had to tell me what it felt like to be a woman who was pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized, because she knew that was the life I had led. At the end of my drinking, I was coming home, and I'd be standing in the shower, and I'd scrub and scrub and scrub, trying to take that dirt off of my body, the dirt that I thought was the dirt I was really trying to clean off. You know, I'd scrub and scrub trying to get rid of that surface dirt. And if you're a real alcoholic, I know the kind of dirt you know that dirt I'm talking about. The kind that you scrub and you scrub and you scrub and it won't come off. It doesn't matter how much soap and water you use. It doesn't matter how much fragrance you use to cover it up. It doesn't matter what kind of clothes you wear, and it doesn't matter who you attach yourself to. That dirt just keeps coming through. And you see, as an alcoholic woman who lived on the streets, who sold her soul to the highest bidder, and sometimes not the highest bidder, you know, I became willing to do absolutely anything. And I'd scrub, and that dirt I kept trying to get off, and it wouldn't leave me. It wouldn't leave me. It didn't leave me until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous years later, and you taught me that the cleansing process had to come from inside of me. That it wasn't about what I wore on the outside. It wasn't about what man I was with today or how much money he had or where I lived or what clothes I wore. It was about who I was inside. And you see, I didn't learn about that until I came to you guys. I didn't learn about being a woman of substance until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God I know about it today, and that's the message I pass on. That's the message I pass on. I pass on a message of how you not drink, how you don't drink one day at a time, and how you use the 12 steps of this program to become different. Because you see, that's the way I was taught in this program, that it's not enough to sit around saying I'm sober and mouthing the words. It's how do I live? How do I live my life? If somebody's looking at me on the street and they are catching me off guard, am I doing something I'd be ashamed to have them see? Am I walking the way I talk? I try. I bet you there are days I fall short. I bet you. I bet you on any given day you can catch me doing something that's probably not so cool. But you know what? Those days are fewer and farther between. And that's only because of what you've given me in this program. You picked me up, you dusted me off, and you made me into the kind of woman that... Well, actually, you made me into the kind of woman I hated when I got sober. You know? I hated women like me when I first came in here. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous I was introduced in 79, and then I continued to drink, and I moved out to Las Vegas, Nevada. Oh boy, the angel capital of the world. I moved out to Vegas, and you know what people often say to me, Francine, how in the world could you get sober in Vegas? How in the world? The most decadent place on the whole planet that admittedly, you know, the booze flows from everywhere. How could you get sober there? And all I say to them, which is the same thing I say to some of you that might think that, I'm a believer that when your number is up, wherever you are lucky enough to be, God bless you. God bless you. And lucky for me, I got sober in Las Vegas at a time when it wasn't as big as it was now. It was more like a family in a small community. But in 1978, I got hit by a car in a blackout. And to date, I don't remember what happened. I am totally incapable of separating the real from the unreal. All I remember is this particular night, I was sitting in this disco that I used to hang out at all the time, called the Brewery, very appropriately named. And the next thing I remember was the next day I came to with my whole body in traction and my left leg was in a cast all the way up my thigh. I didn't have a clue how it happened. But what I was told as pieces started to fit together was the cops found me in the street, on the street where I actually lived in Vegas, Paradise Road. But I was in the street in a direction way opposite from my house. If you know Vegas at all, I lived near DI on Paradise, Desert Inn, and they found me all the way down by Flamingo. And when they found me, they never thought that I would live because I was just this splattered body lying in the street. And when they realized I'd live, they never thought I'd ever walk again because my left leg had come up between my head and the bone had just stuck straight through. And I have a really unattractive 10-inch scar on my leg today as a reminder of those really, really, really good old days, you know. Just in case for a moment I forget where I have come from, I have this beautiful scar to remind me. And I've had people often ask me, Francine, have you ever considered having cosmetic surgery? Because the scar is so ugly. I mean, it is so ugly. And obviously, I don't hide it. I'm wearing a short skirt. I wear shorts. I wear bathing suits. I don't hide it. And when they asked me if I would ever consider cosmetic surgery, you know what? I can only say for today, I haven't. Now, I'm not going to say the day will not come when I may decide to cover it up. But for today, and for the last 22 plus years that I've been sober, every time I look at my leg, I'm reminded of the very high price I had to pay to stand before you this morning. You see, I'm reminded of every drink I took. I'm reminded of every drug I took. And I'm reminded of every inappropriate act as a woman I performed. I'm reminded of everything that got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so just for today, when I look at my leg, it's a gift. It's an opportunity to be grateful for where I've come from and where I'm not anymore. But I'd like to tell you that that was enough to get me sober. And for those of you that are real deal alcoholics and drug addicts sitting in this room, you know that no mere car accident is going to stop you if you're on a mission. And so it was with me. That little car accident just wasn't enough to get me sober. You would have thought so. And perhaps had I been someone who was a social drinker, perhaps it would have happened. Although, had I been a social drinker, I wouldn't have been wandering through the streets of Las Vegas drunk. But it didn't get me sober. You know, it didn't even make me blink an eye. Instead, what it did was made me more angry than I was before. And a little anger, a broken leg, and a little bit more booze just fueled a sickness that was so pathetic to start with. I continued to drink for another 9 months, about 9 months. And then in June of 1979, what I like to call, and what you've taught me, was that moment of clarity is what I experienced. And I don't know why it happened like it did. I don't know why on this particular day I came to wanting to live rather than wanting to die, but I did. I just did. You know, and I remember coming to that morning, and I was drawn to pick up the phone and call Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you see, the good news is I knew about AA when I was living in New York. Again, when I had first crawled into the rooms in 1978, it was in New York City. So I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had even had a big book that I kept somewhere in a closet, stuck somewhere. And yet, I never threw it away. Don't know why. Maybe I didn't throw it away because of this very moment that I knew I was going to need it. And on this day, I opened up that book, and I remembered, you know, I remember almost like it was yesterday. I started reading between the books and between the binders, and I started from the very beginning of the book, the preface, everything. And every time I thought about drinking, I read another chapter. I mean, it was amazing. I just kept reading chapters because I kept wanting to drink. And before I knew it, I had literally read through the entire big book. And this is the third edition I'm talking about. I had read through the entire big book. And then at the end of that book, it was a few days later, and I didn't have a clue what to do. So I thought. What I did was I picked up the phone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous in Vegas. And I pray to God that that is my last first telephone call asking for help. I hope I never have to call again saying, I'm drunk, please come get me. I hope I never have to make that call again. And one day at a time, if I continue to do the things that you've taught me to do, I won't. I would love to tell you that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I had an immediate love affair from the very beginning. I would love to tell you that I came in here and I opened up my arms and I just embraced you all because I knew it was where I was supposed to be. I'd love to tell you that I knew I was home from day one. But the truth is, for me, I wasn't. The truth is, I hated being here. I hated having to admit that alcohol had defeated me. I hated to admit that even though I had sunk so low as a woman, I hated to admit that I was beaten. You see, everybody around me knew it. How could they not know it? But to admit it's another story. To openly say, I am an alcoholic and I can't stop drinking. And you know, if you are newly sober, I just want to say I am especially glad you're here. You know, I couldn't stop drinking from the time I came in from New York until I really got sober in 79. From 78 to 79, I'd show up at meetings in New York and I couldn't stop drinking. And I just want to say for a moment, if there's somebody in this room today who is still drinking or still on something, I just want to say I'm glad you're here. I am so grateful that you've chosen to sit at an AA meeting at this hour of the morning, even though you're still drinking. Let me also say that if you're in here this morning and you're still drinking and you think we don't know, think again. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to be able to distinguish between dilated and constricted pupils. And contrary to popular belief, you can smell booze through the pores. I mean, go figure. I really used to think you couldn't smell vodka. I swear. Don't ask me. And all of you that are sober longer than me, I know you know that's such a joke. But I really thought you come in here and I thought you drink and nobody could smell the vodka as it just oozes out of every pore. Well, they knew about me and we know about you. But I'm happy you're here. I can only speak for myself. I am thrilled that you're here. And my prayer is that you just keep coming around. If you got to drink in between, so be it. So be it. You know, sometimes I go to meetings and I'm personally embarrassed when I hear people, you know, looking down on wet drunks or talking about they don't need to be in here, this is not the place for them. Hello, where is the place for them? This is the place. And for many of us, and I can just tell you, if it wasn't for the kindness of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, those who knew I was drinking and those who didn't, I wouldn't be standing up here this morning. Thank God they never told me I had to leave. Thank God they never told me this was not the place I needed to be, because I wouldn't be here today. But because some of them just kept loving me and everybody didn't, so I'm not going to stand up here and tell you they did. There are a lot of people who had their own issues about that and they had to deal with it. But thank God there are enough people who loved me in spite of myself. And as a result, I just kept coming back. And I get to share that with other people today. I get to be an open heart space for some other new person who's struggling and doesn't think they can do it. You know, one day at a time. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I had a bad attitude from day one. But the truth is, I have always had a bad attitude, so it didn't just cut off when I walked into this program. I hated men and I hated women, and that doesn't leave a whole lot of people in between. I mean, I just didn't like anybody. I grew up in the streets of New York, so I was a tough girl, so I thought. The truth was, I was a really scared girl who had a big, fat, tough exterior around her. And you know what? Because I didn't know how to let you know that I just needed to be hugged sometimes, I acted so big and so bad and so tough, and I wanted you to keep your distance. And the irony is, I wanted hugs, but if you got too close to me, I was ready to fight. You know, I didn't want you to get too close, but yet, I wanted you to. I mean, how sick is that? And thank God for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who saw past that. Probably because they had been there themselves. They saw past my tough girl exterior, and they just loved me until I was capable of loving myself. They taught me how to love myself right here. You know, when I was new, like I said, I didn't like men or women, but in particular, I hated women. In particular, especially the women who were healthy. You know, I didn't like the girls who got up to the platform and talked about, I'm sober today, and I don't do this, and I don't do that, and, you know, I'm living a different kind of life. I used to say, pew, you know, in the back of my, well, I am one of those people who used to sit in the inventory section, actually. It was the section in the back of the room where I would take up, oh, a few of you back there too, is that what the applause are for? I would take up 3 seats. Again, I came in on crutches, so I had one for my bottom, one for my broken leg, and one for my crutches. You know, Miss Prima Donna here. And I would sit in the back in my inventory section just daring you to make my day. And you know what? None of you could. I'd sit in the back picking apart everybody. If you said anything, I picked you apart. But in particular, the women who were just too healthy. You know, I was so jealous. I was so jealous when I got here because I was such a piece of nothing. And I hated women especially because women couldn't be trusted because I couldn't be trusted. See, I saw all women as I saw myself. I was a woman who slept with other people's husbands, who slept with other people's boyfriends, who did lots of inappropriate things. And so I saw all of you as the same way. And if I didn't see you like that, I resented you because I thought you were better than me. Even if you didn't, that's what I thought. And there was one woman who was able to penetrate my core. And lucky me for having sponsors in my life who are... Lucky me for having had sponsors in my life who had the courage of their conviction, who had the courage to call me on my stuff when I didn't want them to. Louise R. out of Las Vegas is, number one, she's terminal right now. So even just talking about her maybe not even being alive in another day or two is very hard. So talk about being in the moment, guys. I am right here, right now. Louise was the first woman who I ever trusted, who I ever loved. And I hated women so much. She was the first woman who taught me that self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. Self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. When I came in here, I was at the bottom, and I behaved that way. And Louise used to say, you know, honey, you can have anything you want out of sobriety, but you got to be willing to show up for it. You got to be willing to show up differently. She said to me, there's an entire chapter called Into Action in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, in that chapter, she said, in that chapter, you'll find the promises. And she said, in that chapter, in the promises, it talks about how we can be different if we are willing to do the work. You know, it was so hard for me to get that from this woman, because in the first place, I thought she was just too old and sober too long, that she just forgot what it was like to be with a newcomer. I mean, when I met her, she was 59 years old and 19 years sober, and I just thought she had long since seen the light. You know, she forgot what it was like to be young and hip. So she was just trying to deprive me from having fun. That was my thinking. You know, I was 26 years old and I wanted to play, and here this old woman is telling me I need to keep my skirt down and I need to do all these things. I thought she must be crazy. She must be out of her mind. I mean, all she ever talked about was action, gratitude, service, and God. Things that I had no idea about and really wasn't interested in learning about. But that's what she kept talking about over and over and over again. Self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. Today, Louise is probably my single greatest mentor. The single most important person in my life is that woman. And because of her, I get to have lots of other people that I love in my life. But it started with her. She taught me how to become the kind of woman that can stand up tall and hold her head up high. Self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. Just want to share with you a couple of the things that she taught me, and I'm not going to say these things because this is what you need to be doing. I'm just sharing this because this is part of my experience. I came in here and I had never in my life, except as a real small teenager, I had never been with a man who was my own, who wasn't shared by someone else, I should say. You know, I was in the habit of dating married men. And that's all I ever did. I dated men who were married, and I dated men who were with other women, even as boyfriends. And I figured if you couldn't keep your husband or your boyfriend, it was not my fault. You know? Learn how to take care of yourself. That was my thinking. And you know what? At 2 years sobriety, Louise taught me that it was not an esteemable act to sleep with somebody else's boyfriend or somebody else's husband. So one day at a time, she taught me how not to do that. And it might seem like a little tiny thing to some of you probably who have never done that before, but for someone like me who always did it, it's a major coup that I don't sleep with anybody else's husband today. It is a major coup that I even have a husband of my own today. You know, go figure that one. But one day at a time, there's not one single woman in this room who would ever have to worry about me being in the same room with her man. Not one of you. That is a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's about walking like I talk. I don't even give them flirty looks. You know, I remember when I was newly sober, I'd be standing up to a guy and holding his shirt as I was running my finger down his chest. This would be somebody else's husband, not just the idiot guy. You know, I'd be looking in his eyes, or if I'd walk down the street, I'd make sure I only connected with the man and never the woman. No way. That's not who I am today. One day at a time. One day at a time, another thing Louise taught me was how to dress appropriately for the occasion. Now, this was another big thing for me, and again, to some of you, it might not be much, but for a kid who used to wear, I have to tell you, I used to wear hot pants so short, they looked like a sash around my butt. And you used to be able to see the cheeks coming through, and I'm not talking about my facial cheeks either. You'd see them hanging out of the bottom of those hot pants when hot pants are really in. I don't even know if they are today or not, but they were so short. And I'd wear blouses that were see-through and open so low cut down to my navel. I mean, a few years ago they made that big stink about Jennifer Lopez and that piece of scarf she wore at the Grammys. She had nothing over on me, girl. I tell you, that's how I used to go sit in AA meetings. Look at my... This is the truth. I have to tell you, I was recently reminded of that. I'm back in New York relatively frequently for business, and I was in New York a few months ago, and I saw some people I had gotten sober with, and one of the guys, we were in a conversation, and he was one of the guys who used to make those comments, and he reminded me of the cheeks and the see-through blouses, and I thought, you know what? Some things you'll just never get rid of, Francine. You'll be having some of that baggage follow you forever. But that's how I used to dress, and I used to think I was cute. And I used to wonder why all the women hated me and all the men wanted my phone number. Just didn't make sense. Didn't understand it. But the other thing that Louise taught me, and again, I particularly say this is not telling you what you need to do. This is just sharing with you my own story. I had a mouth that was so filthy when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, it was disgusting. Every other word out of my mouth was a four-letter word. And I don't know if it was because I didn't know any other words or not, and maybe I didn't, I don't know. But my mouth was so filthy. And so one day at a time, because I had the kind of thick head I had, Louise taught me how not to curse. One day at a time, she taught me it was an esteemable act to find different words to describe how I felt. And it was really hard. It was a challenge because, again, I didn't know too many words. And I only used a few of them, and those are the words I used all the time. And plus, sometimes I realized, or she helped me realize, I can't own that, I would curse in meetings because I always got a laugh. Every time I cursed in an AA meeting, people would laugh. And you know, when you're as insecure as I was, it was better to have some attention rather than no attention. And then one day at a time, she said, you know what, Francine, is that really what's important to you? Is that really what you want? And she taught me how to change it. It's as simple as it got for me. I went from 10 curse words in a sentence to 5 curse words in a sentence. And then it was reduced to like 2 curse words in a sentence. And then before I knew it, it was only 1 curse word per sentence. And before I knew it, I wasn't cursing anymore. For me, that's an esteemable act. One day at a time, I have learned to use other words to describe how I feel. Again, it's not to tell you what to do. It's just, this has been my experience. I've expanded my vocabulary as a result, and, you know, one day at a time, that's been a gift of my recovery. Louise taught me how to be a lady. She taught me how to become the kind of woman that I could respect, inside and outside. And as those inside changes were taking place, the outside was also changing. I made a decision when I was 2 years sober to go back to school, which was a monumental change for somebody like me, because I'd never been educated. You know, I was not smart. And even when I was in school, I was never really there. You know, I would hang out with the boys. I was on drugs in the 60s in New York. What else do? You go hang out. And, oh, God, I just had a quick senior moment. A quick one. It just flashed in. I'm almost 50. You know, it must have something to do with that. I bet you it does. God, I'm up there with you just about. It happens sometimes. I don't even get freaked out anymore, you know. Sometimes I just lose it, And then it'll come back, and sometimes it doesn't come back, and you know, the gift of sobriety is I am now under this table because, oh my God, I made a mistake. I'm going to die. So at 2 years sober, I made a decision to go back to school. And it was a major move for me because, again, I had been a high school dropout, and none of the men, none of my benefactors ever asked me where I went to college or where I went to school. They didn't ask me if I was educated. They didn't care whether I had a degree. All they cared about was how I looked and whether I could perform. And that's all I ever cared about, too. But you know what? At 2 years sober, something started to shift. And it was you. The things that you had been teaching me up until that point, while I was resistant, some little things were seeping in inside. And, you know, this moment in time, because there might be, and I would suspect there are some of you in the audience today who are like me, who are dreamers. And maybe you come across a lot of people who I call dream busters. And they try to squash your dream, and, you know, they tell you you can't do stuff, and they tell you you're not good enough, and they tell you, oh, don't go for the goal because you'll never make it. You see, when I was growing up, I used to hear that. I was told, Francine, don't go for the moon because you'll never get there. You'll never, ever get there. Somebody who's come from where you've come from, forget it. You'll never amount to anything. You might as well just think about marrying somebody with money because you'll never do anything on your own. They said, go for the top of the fence. You can have that, but don't go for the moon. And you know what? I bought into that line of thinking for so long. When people told me I couldn't do things, I believed them. I believed them. It was an estimable act for me to finally shift that thinking to stop believing them. So if there's somebody in here tonight, this morning, who has a dream inside, and you know, now you're sober and it's like, what else can I do? You know, what can sobriety allow me to do with my life? I can only tell you that the sky is the limit. One day at a time, when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you get to show up for yourself in ways you never, ever, ever thought possible if you are willing to do the work. And thank God I had a sponsor like Louise who kept saying, go for it. Go for it. She said, you know what? If you want to use excuses to not do what you really want to do in recovery, you can do that. We're not going to stop you. She said, if you want to use your race as an excuse for not succeeding in life, go for it. And you see, I was really good at using the fact that I'm black. Poor me, I'm black. They won't let me do it. Whoever they are, I don't know. But it was like, they won't let me do it. Or I use the fact that I'm a girl. Poor me, I'm only a girl. You know, I can't do anything with my life. Or poor me, look at my past. I'll never amount to anything. I'll never be able to do anything with that kind of baggage. I had been to jail. I mean, I couldn't, they wouldn't let me do anything. This is what my thinking was. And Louise would say to me, if you believe that you can't, you won't. It's that simple. If you believe that you can't, you won't. But she said it's an estimable act to at least try. And so one day at a time, I made a decision, even though people laughed at me and made fun of me and told me that I was crazy to be going for my dream, I showed up anyway. And I started, I had been a high school dropout, so I needed to get a GED for anything I wanted to do, and I was so ashamed of being a dropout. I had bought a big book, and I had lied also, I forgot to tell you that. I was a big time liar. I lied about things I didn't even have to lie about, and maybe some of you can relate. I just lied, because I could. And I would lie and tell people that I had gone to high school and I had graduated, and I had even gone so far as to tell people that I had gone to some college. Now, anybody with two teeth in their mouth knew that that couldn't be possibly true. When they listened to me talk, they knew I had no education, but I just kept lying. But when the time came for me to change that, I was so ashamed that I bought this book, and every time company would come to the house, I would hide my book under my bed. Because I didn't want you guys to know I really was a dropout. But you know what? Even though I was ashamed, I had smart feet. And that's what Louise taught me. My feet are smart. My belief system may have been saying one thing, but my feet were smart. I was willing to do the footwork. And so I studied and I studied and I got my GED and then I started school, college in Las Vegas, Nevada. And then I moved back to New York City in 1982 to pursue a dream that was just so far beyond anything I could possibly imagine for myself. Couldn't imagine it. And I worked my way through college. I worked full-time, I went to school full-time, and I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And it's really important that I share that part with you, because very often I see people between those delicate years of 1 to 5 who are all back in life. They're back in school, they have the right job, they're in the right relationship, and they just kind of forget about the reason they're able to do all this stuff. They forget about AA, and every now and then they'll pop up in a meeting maybe a month or two later, and then we are stuck with listening to all the stuff that builds up over the time they're not here. And so Louise said to me, you know what, sobriety can work under those conditions. No question about it. You can go to one meeting every 2 months and still stay sober. But she said it works better if you do it on a regular basis. She says also you have a responsibility to show up and let people know the gifts that you've been given in recovery. She said you have a responsibility to the new people under you to let them see that sobriety really works. She said, if everybody who's doing something runs away and stops going to AA meetings, then how do new people ever know this deal really, really works? So it was for my own benefit I had to come to meetings, and it was for yours, so she told me. And I kept showing up, and I resented coming to meetings. Sometimes, I mean, after working a full-time job and going to school full-time, the last thing I wanted to do was sit in a meeting. But I did it. I did it. And lucky me, because when the time came for me to really need this program at a very difficult time that was to come up, I had put enough insurance in my policy. I had shown up enough, and you knew that I was showing up for myself, so you were willing to show up for me. In 1986, I graduated from college and I moved down to Washington, D.C., which is when I got to meet Ed C., who is one of the people that I love so much as well. And I got to meet him and Hal Marley, who maybe some of you know, and Hal's one of my other mentors in this program, and Hal just recently died. And you know, I've been thinking lately of many of my mentors are old. You know, Louise is old and she's dying, and Hal just died, and Paul, who was another one of my mentors who died 2 years ago. It's like, I guess the good news is if you stay around long enough, you get to have people that you love and admire. And if you stay around long enough, we get to die. But the good news, I've had these people in my life, and when I went to when I went back to school, when I was in Washington, I'm just so glad that they were there to get me through the 3 years of school. In 1989, I graduated from one of the top law schools in this country, and I have to tell you, for somebody like me who used to pay lawyers a lot of money to keep her out of jail, it is unbelievable that I get to stand up here before you and tell you that I can practice law somewhere. It is so unbelievable. Unbelievable. Thank you. And you know, and I know you know that this is your victory as much as it is mine, because there is no way in the world I would have been able to get through school had it not been for Alcoholics Anonymous. Had it not been for yays and nays in Washington every Tuesday morning and every other meeting I went to, anywhere, I would have never been able to show up as I have. I'd like to tell you that on this journey of becoming a lawyer was a really easy piece of cake. But again, I'm one of those speakers that gets up and just tells you the truth. You know, you take it, you don't, but it's the truth. And having dreams is one thing. Making them come true can sometimes be hard. And one of the things that I hear as I go along my journey today, people are afraid to live their dreams because they're afraid that they're going to fail. And somehow or another, we teach our children and we teach each other that failure is the worst thing that could happen to us. How sad for us to teach that. And how sad for us to buy into that. I'm living proof that you can survive through failures over and over and over again. And I'm here to say to anybody who has a dream, and maybe you've already failed something, and you know, it's just so devastating, you never thought you'd get through it, show up again. Show up again. I'm also here to tell you that it's not easy, but only the courageous show up for the game. You see, most of my life I used to sit back on the sidelines taking the inventory of the people who had the courage to live the life they really wanted, because I didn't have the guts to do what I wanted to do. So it was easier for me to sit back here and judge you if you failed, if you stumbled. It was like, ha, 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 look at them, they can't even pass a test or something. It was easy for me to do that because I didn't have the guts to get up and even take the test. Today I'm one of those people that gets up, that dusts myself off, and starts over and over and over again. In order to have become a lawyer, I had to fail the bar. And I need to say that to you because, again, I know that there's some of you who fail tests or you're afraid to go for what you want because you're afraid to fail. You know, my greatest learning has come through my failures. And the more I'm able to speak about it, the less sting it has, the less control it has over me. I took the New York bar twice before I was able to pass it. And I have to tell you, the day I passed the bar, it was the same day me and John F. Kennedy Jr. were like right there together. We both failed it together, we both were admitted to the bar together, and we, you know, it was like he was my brother. When he died, that was a tough one for me. It was like a sibling had passed on. But I got to show up for a dream. And you know, then I got to show up for a dream. And then what's happened over the last few years is I have, through a number of reasons and a number of decisions, I made a decision no longer to practice law. And, you know, I struggled with the California bar when I first moved out to California. I've taken that test more than I even want to tell you, actually. You know, I took it and I took it, and then what I also discovered in this life is sometimes we have to let go. For a moment. Might be permanent, might not be. But when I moved out to California, one of the things I was afraid of was having to take the California bar, which was a bear of an exam. And I took it, and I took it, and it had eaten me up so much over the years. I couldn't do anything but think about that exam. I had become so consumed with taking and passing this exam that I needed to let go of it. And I decided that if I ever take it again, I will never tell you guys. It'll be my secret, just because I don't want to have to go through that again. But for today, I've let go of it. What has happened in the interim is something so far beyond my wildest imaginings. You know, it's amazing what happens through seeming failures. Sometimes there are opportunities that we never, ever, ever think are possible, but they can only surface when we let go of one thing, when we allow one door to close and another one to open up. Another dream that I have had for many, many years, even when I was still practicing law, was that I always wanted to write. But I was ashamed to write because I knew if I wrote anything, that would go down in history and you'd always be looking at my mistakes. That's what I was afraid of. And Dr. Paul, who was one of my greatest mentors, Dr. Paul was the first person that ever told me I had a book inside of me. And before Paul died 2 years ago, we had been together at a conference in Mexico. We were at a conference in Mexico. And one of the last things he said to me is, "Francine, don't stop doing this book." Because I had put that on the shelf because of my fear. And I just want to say that another dream come true for me is I get to have a book. I have a book that's coming out that I am a writer today. I have had an opportunity to write a book. It's like, who would have thought? Another dream come true in Alcoholics Anonymous. And had I not let go of the failures of the bar exam, I would have never gone to something that was really so important to me. You know, when I was newly sober, I was invited to make a list of all the things I wanted out of my sobriety. And on that list, you would have found kitty cats and fur coats and diamond rings and material things. Nothing that really, really was of value, except my cats, of course. And today on that list, what you'd find are things, those intangible things that you can't take away from me unless I choose to give them up. You'd find things on my list today like self-esteem, the genuine kind for me that comes from walking through my fear. You see, every single time I do something I'm afraid to do today, and I get to the other side, it's like a little check mark next to my name. Going back to school to become a lawyer was an act of courage. It was an esteemable act. Practicing law was an esteemable act for me because it was something I wanted to do. Stop practicing law, not practicing law anymore, for me today was an esteemable act. Letting go of the California bar was an esteemable act. Going for my dream of writing is an esteemable act. Every time I do something I'm afraid to do, getting up in front of a group and sharing the truth about my life, the difficult stuff and the painful stuff as well as the good stuff, is a courageous act. That's what you'd find on my list today. What you'd also find on my list today is the gift of love. You know, when I was newly sober, like I said, I didn't like anybody. I absolutely hated everyone, and I came in here judging everybody by the 2% of the things that I believe separate me from you: race, religion, and sexual preferences. That's all I judged you by. And I came in here hating you like some of you probably came in here hating me, just for superficial stuff. And one of the gifts of my recovery has been the gift of an open heart. And that's a gift that's not just about lip service either. It's about how I really live my life today. It's one thing to say from a distance, I like people who are different, or I will connect with people who are different. It's another to bring you in my family circle. And you see, today, my life is living proof that I am working so hard to get rid of the hatred that I grew up with as a young black child. So much so that if you look at my coterie friends, my friends are black and white and Asian and Latino and Native American. If you look at my family, my husband's Jewish and he's from the Bronx. You know, and the real diversity issue in my family is not that my husband is Jewish and from the Bronx, it's that he's a therapist. That's the real diversity issue. A lawyer and a therapist, go figure. You know, one day at a time I get to walk the way I talk. I get to have friends in my life that I would have never even given the time of day to because I didn't like that they slept with people who were different from who I slept with. I have friends that are gay everywhere. You know, that's a gift of an open heart for me. I have friends who are different religions. You know, for me, I'd be hard-pressed to tell you that I'm working any kind of 12-step program today. I'd be hard-pressed to tell you I'm working any kind of spiritual program and hate anybody for the color of their skin or for the religion they choose to be a part of or no religion at all or for who they choose to sleep with. I'd be hard-pressed to tell you I'm working this 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So one day at a time, I get to open my heart even just a little bit more. And you know what? My challenges are many. I'd love to stand up here and tell you that I'm always able to easily embrace everyone. I'm not. But my challenge and my gift is that I get to practice. What you'd also find on that list today is the gift of my mom. And I know that that's a really naughty word to say sometimes in an AA meeting, you know, but it's a gift for me. I'm very grateful for the women when I first got sober who hated their mothers. I am so grateful because when I heard you ladies talk about how you couldn't stand your moms, it made me feel less of a leper. You know, I felt like I was a part of because I hated my mother too. But I can also tell you that when the time came for me to change my attitude, which again is what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me, to change my attitude and my behavior, when that time came, I was so grateful for the women in Alcoholics Anonymous who showed me how to practice that, how to put into practice the 12 steps, not just with some people, but with my family in particular. See, it was the women in AA who taught me how to love my mother. It was the women in AA who taught me that while I was out there pointing the finger at my mother being such a horrible mom, there were three more fingers pointing back at me. And that I had to take a look at what kind of daughter I had been. Maybe I didn't have the greatest mother. Maybe I didn't have the greatest childhood. But you know what? I wasn't a day in the park as a kid either. You know, I was a piece of work. At every turn, I challenged my mother. I created havoc in my house. So one day at a time, I had to learn how to be a nicer daughter. And especially since I was wanting my mother to be so different, I'm the one who's in recovery, not my mother. So who's the one who has the greater responsibility? I learned that here. And as a result, my mother and I have a relationship that is so sweet. Is it perfect? By no stretch of the imagination. But it's sweet. We're in relationship with each other. And you know, I hear so many people, and it's such a sad thing, but it's where we are, I guess. People who, after their parents have died or someone who was close to them has died, then they not only are riddled with anger and resentment, but they're riddled with guilt because they say, I wish I would have. That's not going to be my experience. You see, if my mom were to drop dead right this very moment, I'd be so hurt and so sad, but I would not feel guilty because there is no unfinished business with my mother and I. 2 years ago, I took my mother to Hawaii for her 70th birthday. She had never gone to Hawaii and she always wanted to go. And for me, any opportunity I get to go Hawaii, I'll go, you know. And so I had planned this trip for her, and It was so special. We shared a room together for a whole week. And I have to tell you, it was special, but it was also quite challenging. Quite challenging. We were in the whole room. And I have to tell you, too, that by the end of that week, I didn't ever want to see my mother again. I didn't ever want to see her again. But the second thought in my mind was, you're going to keep trying this deal. You're not going to give up on her just like you don't want her to give up on you. And I took my mother on another trip last year. And you know what? They just keep getting better. We're planning a cruise. We're planning a cruise, probably for my 50th birthday next year. You know, we're planning a cruise. So when the book comes out, me and my mother will go somewhere. It'll be really great. But my mom is something you'd find on that list. What a gift. What you'd also find on that list is God. You know, I came in here a non-believer. I came in here an agnostic. I didn't believe that there was no God. I just didn't believe for me God didn't exist. I believed for me God didn't exist. It was forced down my throat as a kid, as a Southern Baptist. So I knew God was around, but just not for me. Just not for me. And today, my relationship with God is like the relationship in the 12 and 12 and the 11th step. It talks about some of us would no more do without our faith than we would air, food, or sunshine. You see, the only reason I get to stand up here and do anything, the only reason I get to stand up here and share with you my life and do anything I've done in my life is because of God. It's because of a faith that works under all conditions. A faith that has not let me down even when I've turned my back on it. It has not let me down. How grateful I am for a relationship like that. And finally, what I want to say is what you find on that very special list today are the gift of friends and mentors. I choose to call them angels. And they come in all different shapes, and they come in all different sizes, and they come in all different religions, and they just come from everywhere. And people like Hal, and people like Ed, and you know, people like Paul, and people like Louise, and people like my mom. My mom I consider an angel in my life today. The gift of friends, the gift of relationships. And it's all because I showed up one day at a time when I didn't drink. I'd like to close by reading something from conference-approved literature, just in case there are some AA purists sitting out in the room, and I'm sure there are a few of you. This is from As Bill Sees It, and it's my most favorite book. This and the 12 and 12 are my two most favorite books, and I'm grateful for all the AA literature, and I'm grateful for a sponsor who believed that the answers were in the books. You know, if you're new and you've never cracked one of these books, I just encourage you to do it. I mean, it's a treasure trove of information. And this one I always like to read because it's so special. When I came in so angry when I was new, and I like to say that my face was in a pissed-off position, which is how it always was, Louise had me read this book. She had me read everything in As Bill Sees It under resentment and anger, and she had me read everything in here under gratitude and faith. And it's amazing what happens when you take direction. It's really amazing what happens. And I just fell in love with this. And so I always like to end my talks with this passage on page 4. It's entitled, Can We Choose? We must never be blinded. I keep forgetting, you know, I have to wear glasses now to read. I'm in denial, actually. God. That's how I know I'm getting older. Excuse me. We must never be blinded by the futile philosophy that we are just the hapless victims of our inheritance, of our life experience, and of our surroundings, that these are the sole forces that make our decisions for us. This is not the road to freedom. We have to believe that we can really choose. And that's what you've given me in 22 and a half years of sobriety. You've given me the gift of choice. You've taught me that it doesn't matter where I've come from, doesn't matter what color my skin is, doesn't matter whether I believe in God or I don't. You've taught me that the only thing that matters in the overall scheme of things is how I connect with you guys, my fellow travelers. Whether it's in an AA meeting or outside of an AA meeting. You've taught me that it matters how I connect with you in traffic. You taught me that it matters how I connect with you on the line in the supermarket or the bank. You taught me that it matters how I connect with you at home. Do I treat my husband like a dog and treat my sponsees like goddesses? You tell me one day at a time, the key is in my action. The key is in my behavior. I could say all kinds of things, but how do I treat my fellow travelers along the way? And you've taught me that the other only thing that matters is that I be willing to constantly give it away. That I never be so selfish that I want to hoard what gifts you have given me, whether they be my time, my money, my energy, my spirit. That I always be willing to share with you because somebody was willing to share with me. Thank you so much for my sobriety. Bye-bye.